This is OPB. Today on OPB, we hear former Oregon Governor Vic Atiyah in an interview with reporters and staff from OPB Radio and the Salem Statesman Journal. Vic Atiyah is a Republican. He was elected governor in 1978 and reelected in 1982. In this interview, he talks about his experiences in Oregon politics and reflects on some of his accomplishments as governor. He also talks about the state of politics in Oregon today, sharing his perspective on the legislature, the effects of term limits, and the state's initiative and referendum system. The interview took place on Tuesday, March 20th in the offices of the Statesman Journal. Former Governor Vic Atiyah answers questions after an opening statement.
Part of what you asked me was, of course, to tell you who I am, and it's that I am Victor Atiyah, former governor of Oregon. Spent 20 years in the Oregon legislature, six of those as a House member and 14 as a senator, and 8 years as a governor. Also, 35 years full-time in our family retail rug business. When I think back on it, it's really quite unusual to have somebody from small business be elected to the high office of governor. And I'm very proud of that. It's been said, and probably is correct, that no one had come to that office with such a long experience in both the legislature and as a businessman. Coincidentally, I was sworn in as a member of the House of Representatives on January 12, 1959, and I left office and public life January 12, 1987, the same day. Now, we know it's the second Monday in January, but it just happened to work out that way. During the course of our discussion, of course, you're going to ask any question you want to ask, but I do hope we cover things like the budget, annual sessions, violence among our citizens. Some people ask me, do I miss it? And they continue to ask me the question, and my answer is always the same. I don't miss the process, but I do miss the opportunity of running the state the way I think the state should run. And that would also mean, of course, that I'm not always in exact accord the way the state is being run. There really isn't any rule anywhere, but I think it's been universal the same. What is it, Reagan talked about the 11th commandment, thou shalt not speak ill about the Republicans. But it seems to me there's an 11th commandment for former governors that thou shalt not speak bad about your successors. Although I may today, I don't know. briefly, I had a conversation with the Senate President just on my own initiative. I called him and I told him, Gene, I said, look, as you deal with the budget, I'm just going to give you some principles. I'm not going to say what or anything, but I've kind of was guided by looking at budgets, what is essential and what is desirable. Now, that's how you approach it. I think essential is pretty easily described or agreed to, but desirable, of course, you have varying degrees of desirable, and that becomes arguable. However, as you know, I dealt with the budget. I had four special sessions for the sole purpose of rebalancing the budget. And incidentally, there have only been eight of those in the entire history of Oregon, and I called half, three in 1 year in 1982. Three special sessions to rebalance the budget. I called Senator Randy Miller and I said, look, I don't, you know, you always want to know ahead of time, and I've never tried to blindside anybody, but on the issue of annual sessions, I will either be the active chairman against it, or I will be a very active honorary chairman. And I do have some strong thoughts about violence. Well, that be enough to kind of crank things up. So just do what you want.
Okay. Governor Atiyah, Richard Aguirre with the Statesman Journal. Can you start by giving us a recap of why you decided to become involved in a public life and stray from your business for a while?
Okay. There wasn't really a moment. I'll just give you the kind of history of it, because the question's been asked before. I have to look back to see why, but I was always very interested in what was happening in government. I was vocal about it as we all sat around the living room and chat and talk. I voted every election because I just thought it was important. I was impressed, among the reasons I think I felt so strongly, is when my father passed away. I was 21 at the time, and there was an editorial about him in the newspaper. I thought, gee, what a great country. A guy comes from a little village in Syria and becomes a prominent citizen in his own community. Anyway, I continue that, and my friend said, you ought to run for the legislature someday, and I said, yeah, and it had the same meaning to me as let's go to the moon someday. I just didn't have any meaning. One day, as a typical, I found out later, a friend of mine called, and he was gone to the central the county committee, Republican, the Multnomah County Republican Committee, and they were looking for candidates. That's something I learned later on, and my name was mentioned. He said, well, he's not from Multnomah County, he's from Washington County. So he called me, are you thinking of running for the legislature? And I said, well, yeah, someday. And he said, why not now? That started the whole process. I've never been in the Capitol building until I came to file. The other question, how come you still run so long? I never had a path that I wanted to follow. I didn't say, gee, was next year I want to run again, or someday I want to be a governor or anything like that. I continued when I felt it was useful and worthwhile, when I thought I was doing something, and it just sort of happened. When it came time to run, as I did for governor, I of course been around for quite a long time. I thought, well, I can run this state, I think, better than those that have run it in the past. So anyway, that's a sort of short version.
Governor Richard Aguirre with the Statesman. Do you think there are as many opportunities today for people who might want to get involved in politics, or has there something changed about the dynamic?
This may come as a surprise to you, but I think there's greater opportunity for, for someone that has a full-time job. And the reason I tell you that is that someone who doesn't have a full-time job, they're free to go door-to-door every day, all day. And obviously someone who doesn't have, who does have a full-time job doesn't have that opportunity. And that becomes very difficult for someone like that. So I would say the most difficult part for someone running for office is someone that is working full-time, has a full-time job. That's the most difficult part.
Governor Attia, Bill Lunch from OPB. One of the changes which has been much discussed in the years since you left your post as governor has been the increased incidence of initiatives, and some of those have had really profound effects on the governance of the state. I wonder if you have any observations about how the initiative process has changed in the years since you left as governor, and whether, as some critics of the initiative process argue, essentially the initiative process has become the dominant form of governance in the state.
Of course, I've thought about that quite a bit, and I am not yet impressed with trying to stem the process, to try to make it more difficult. So much in this society of ours depends on people. And I've walked the street, I've seen people stopping people to get signatures, and so often people will sign it and they don't really understand what it is they're signing. So the first step is for people to put it on the ballot, not those that go out and get signatures. And so here I am again. Again, I say, people have complained about elected officials, and I say, well, who put them there? People put them there. And the same thing, ballot measures, who put them there? The people put them there. And they have to be more inquisitive. They don't have to sign. They're not embarrassed. You know, they think, well, I have to better sign this. I'll be embarrassed. So they put it on. I'm not concerned about that. Costs a lot. It takes a lot of emotion and time. I don't know if I'd do anything to stem it. We've had some ups and downs. There have been years even within my career. You know, there have been a lot, maybe not as many as this last time, which was an awful lot. But I don't know as if I try to slow it down.
Governor Bill Lunch again. A related aspect of this that some folks have commented upon is that as initiatives have become more costly and more profound in their impact on governing the state, the role of the legislature has declined. And that's sometimes one argument that's made in favor of annual sessions, particularly with the advent of term limits. You've said a little earlier this morning that you're opposed to annual sessions. Can you relate your reasons for that and connect that, if you will, to the perception, at least among some folks, that the legislature is a weaker institution now than it was when you were governor?
If there's any hope at all for what's called a citizen legislature, it'll be wiped out with annual sessions. Bad enough now. Bad enough, and certainly in the face of term limits, which wiped out experience and institutional memory, leaving it then to the bureaucrats to run, because they'll always be there, but legislators come and go. There really isn't any need for special sessions. We have all the tools available. Stay in session till we make the decisions. Or either the legislature or the governor can call special sessions if there's a really emergency. So there's no need to do this annually. And then, as I read it, there was a proposal that there would be a limited number of days, and that of course, continuing the legislature or the governor can call special sessions. And I can tell you, if it were to pass, I can tell you exactly what will happen. They will go over. The legislature will call themselves into special session. And so it's a sham. It's an absolute sham. My strong feeling, if I try to give it to you as strong as I can, is that I still have hopes of citizen legislature, in spite of the fact that the elections have changed, as Richard had mentioned to me, in spite of the fact that there are people who aren't as well equipped as they should be when they go to the legislature, meaning they haven't had the opportunity to make decisions, they don't quite know how to make a decision, or they don't have enough background or knowledge to be able to make a decision. Well, I guess I just say we don't need it. I don't know what our argument will be if it gets on the ballot. You know, we have a campaign plan when that happens, if it does happen. But I will tell you that if there's any hope whatsoever, it's going to be wiped out with annual sessions.
Peter Wong, Statesman Journal. I have a couple of questions about the governorship, when past and when maybe future. Not with your own plans, however. In 1974, you ran for governor and lost. Was it difficult in 1978 when you ran again and won to make the decision to run statewide? What was it like running a statewide campaign, especially a second time when you did win?
I would tell you, Peter, exactly my own state of mind. Recalling that 1974 was the year that Nixon resigned and Ford pardoned Nixon. And it was probably the pardoning of Nixon was even more dynamite than the Nixon resigning. Dynamite, that is, in terms of Republicans running for office. I've said, and I think it's probably fair, that I don't have any idea if I could have won had that not happened. I don't know that. But I'm sure it had some kind of an impact on the election. Nonetheless, after I had lost it, and I knew ahead of time I was going to lose. I didn't say that to my volunteers, but you know, I'm out there and I have a sense of what's going to happen. I said facetiously that people gave me a mandate to go back in the rug business, but I wasn't devastated like I've seen some others who have lost the election. They really were very devastated by the loss. I wasn't. I said to myself, I know I am where Oregonians are. I just didn't get that message across. Now, also in my mind, I said, as the time approached to whether I was going to run again, if I thought Bob Straub could be beat, I was going to run. If I thought that he was not going to get beat, then it wasn't fun just to go out there and lose again. And so I made a decision that, yes, he could be beat. I do want to quickly say, however, that it wasn't because of Bob Straub, who, in my mind, is a fine human being. I really have great affection for him. He didn't pick the best people to advise him, and they didn't let Bob be Bob. And he's a very down-to-earth, great sense of humor sort of a guy. Anyway, that wasn't a tough decision. I thought, yes, he could be beat, and that's why I went at it again.
Fast forward, since your re-election in 1982, no Republican has been elected governor since. If a Republican came to you for advice today about how a Republican can win the governorship 20 years later, what kind of advice would it be?
Oh, all kinds of advice. I've said that to our Republican candidates. You know, let me help you. Let me give you advice. And I've given the litany of all the races I've run, all of which I was supposed to lose. I was supposed to lose to Clay Myers, and of course I won that one. I did lose in 74 on the reason that, you know, I just mentioned. I'd lost 55-45, and that wasn't too bad. Obviously, running again, I wasn't supposed to be an incumbent Democrat governor. I beat him, and I wasn't supposed to beat that charismatic Tom McCall or Roger Martin, and I won that one. And certainly I wasn't supposed to beat Kulongoski, who was even more charismatic and the candidate type, a Democrat. But I won them all. I'd say, well, gee, somebody say, how do you do that? You asked me what would I advise them. First of all, I said at Dorchester that I certainly treasure the title of governor, but I'd be willing very much to give up the title of the last Republican governor, and I'm ready for that any time now. And I just advise them, those that are out there now, I feel pretty good about. When I say that, Jack Roberts, Ron Saxton, and Craig Berkman has been mentioned, and I say to myself, well, gee, was that's not a bad bunch to make a choice from. I tell them to get organized. What wins election is good organization, a lot of volunteers, and having a campaign plan that you do not deviate from. If you can remember, when the first time, a good comparison to me was the Bush Dukakis campaign. Bush clearly had a campaign plan. He stuck to it and went all the way, and he won. Dukakis kept changing his every week. Depends on what was going on out there, and that weakens a campaign. That's my example. I think fundamentally that's it. There's a lot of other little things one can do, but those two things are very important.
Governor Attia, Colin Fogarty with OPB Radio. I had another question, but you mentioned Ted Kulongoski, and that that made me think of a different question. The candidates that are being, the names that are being tossed around for governor in 2002 are relatively new people in Oregon politics, but the one person that's being talked about, of course he hasn't declared, is Supreme Court Justice Ted Kulongoski. Do you think as a Democrat he would make a good candidate? Is he a force to be reckoned with? Is he the favorite on the Democratic side? Or who would you say is the favorite on the Democratic side?
I don't really know. Well, of course, you know Hill. I don't really know them all that well to be able to tell you. By that, I mean measuring. I do know Kulongoski. He is a good man. I think being on the bench, I've always kidded the judges. You know, once you become a judge, you remove yourself from society. You know, they don't want to say anything. Maybe you get too much of that to be a good candidate. I don't know, but I think he's mature enough. He speaks well. I think he'd make a good candidate. Well, that's my answer to it. Yeah.
Having said that, I'm sure you'd vote against him, but.
I would tell you this, and it did surprise me. This is sort of an addendum. You didn't ask. I was governor at the time when I ran for re-election. We had those three special sessions while I was there during my campaign, which meant I called a session, had to plan the budget cuts and revenue raising. We were dealing with the Bhagwan. And I say all of that because I was out there with all that going on. I actually physically out-campaigned Kulongoski, physically out-campaigned him, which surprised me. I thought, you know, he was a senator, he has time to campaign, but I out-campaigned him. Now, what?
Well, I wanted to ask you one question about a law that you signed or a bill that you signed into law back in 1979, the kicker. Am I getting that correct, that it was 1979 that passed?
I think it was in 79 it passed, yeah.
Okay. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the rationale for signing it, especially since it seems to be a hot-button issue again this session, as it has been every session since it was signed.
Well, it wasn't a hot button at that point in time. The reason I signed it is I had a very strong feeling that we had what I would call a surplus, that the people overpaid. And they should get their money back. So that's the philosophy behind the whole thing, and that's why there was no problem dealing with it at that point in time. It wasn't a problem, and as a matter of fact, it was never suggested, even when we had our budget balancing sessions, that we take that kicker money and use it to balance the budget. Never even got to that point. I think it's good. I do believe that if the people pay too much, they ought to get it back. It just seems fair to me.
So, I mean, under the circumstances now, I mean, do you think that given the constraints the legislature is under, do you think that they should dip into the kicker or should they leave it alone?
I would tell you that in balancing a budget, there's two ways to do that. And one is, of course, to raise money. The other is to cut budgets. There's not one way to do it. There's two ways to do it. And as I've watched how government operates today, I think there is room to cut some budgets. You have to ask me a follow-up question on that one if you want. But anyway, I feel that there is room. And that budget cutting is a better source instead of trying to take away what's called an overpayment. It's an interesting discussion. I will tell you this historically, because it never came to light, that the estimate is made in 2008, and if the money comes in that exceeds that estimate by 2%, then it all goes back to the electorate. And I proposed that it was always a Democrat legislature while I was a governor, well, it was through my entire career. I proposed that if it exceeded the 2%, that amount over the 2% would be used for government and that the people would get the 2%. And they didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole at that point in time. But as I say, you wouldn't know that because it never came to the light of day.
Governor Attia, Bill Lunch from OPB, you seem to have opened the door here in your last response to following up to ask if you're going to cut budgets, which ones would you cut under the current circumstances?
Well, It probably was almost unfair because you have to be there to do it. But there's some little things that are more of a style and that would lead you somewhere that don't cost. They're not very large, but nonetheless they have some meaning. Let me give you a couple, and I'll treat them equally, meaning Republicans and Democrats. I mentioned earlier to someone here that every time I get there's a problem and there's a response from the governor's office, it's the governor's advisor for whatever it is. This happens all the time. I said, how many advisors does he have? He has an advisor for every subject that comes up. Why do you need that many advisors? I don't know that. It's a good question to ask. Why do you need all these advisors? And they're getting paid, incidentally. That's the Democrat side. I think, really, the legislature itself can operate with less of a staff than it has at the present time. I was kind of surprised. Last session, I had lunch in the Senate lounge, and I can do that because I was a senator, so that's permissible. And I asked one of the senators, I said, gee, you've had in the past these little booklets that give the legislators and their address and their phone number, and it's maybe a little booklet, maybe a quarter inch high, half inch or more. Do you have one of those? Yes. I says, I'll get you one. Well, my goodness, it's Reader Digest size, about maybe an inch thick, and all of the names that are there and all, you know, I've forgotten 400 or 500 or a large number of people working in the legislative branch. Of course, I wouldn't look at that. The legislature has to do that if I were a governor, but the point is there's a place. Now, neither one they would contend, well, it doesn't cost very much. And it's several billion dollars, that's true. But let me give you another story. Again, it never reached the light of day. Well, I was doing the budgets, and I did the budgets, as those that are around me at the time knew. I worked on the budgets myself, and I can recall, although I can't recall the item, and I said, well, gee, Governor, that's only $75,000. And I said, yes, in a multi-billion dollar budget, that $75,000 isn't very much. But, I said, how would you like to have that in your checkbook? And then it becomes real money. And that's what I'm saying, thinking about. There's so many people out there that thinks that all this is poker chips. It isn't real money. And, you know, people, you all work, and you pay your taxes. You send it in there. Would you spend it the way they spend it? I'm not only talking about state government, which is usually much better than the federal government. But, you know, there's too many that think this is anonymous. This is not real. A story. I was playing with a group that had met annually and had a good time for a weekend, and they had a poker game, small game and a big game. So I said one day, well, yep, I'll get in the big game. So I won a few hands, and pretty soon I can remember. Somebody said, I'll bet $5, throws a chip in. And I said, well, I'll see your five, and I'll raise you five. And then on the raise, I said, what in the hell am I doing? If that were a $5 bill, I wouldn't let go of it. But it was a chip. You know, that's what wasn't real money. That's the way I think many people think of the tax dollar today.
Former Oregon Governor Vic Atiyah, he served as governor from 1979 to 1987. The next question comes from OPB political analyst Bill Lunch.
I wanted to go back to the question that Peter asked you a few moments ago concerning your advice to Republican candidates. One of the other observations that a number of people who follow state politics have made is that in the years since you were governor, the Republican Party has frequently nominated candidates such as Denny Smith or more recently Bill Sizemore, who are so far to the right that they are out of the mainstream of the views of Oregon voters. and one of the reasons, therefore, for Republican failure on statewide races has been this persistence in nominating candidates who are simply too conservative for the center of gravity in the state's politics. Have you observed that? Do you think that's an accurate perception on the part of those who are making it?
It's true that both Denny and particularly Bill Sizemore had very large speed bumps out there in terms of their election. They had some hurdles to get over. Denny less so than Sizemore, but nonetheless it's true what you just said. However, when we look at Norma Paulus and Dave Fromar, those are entirely different cases, and we lost those. Certainly Dave Fromar was a classic example of the, in this case, the ultra-conservatives actually beat Dave. It wasn't that he lost the race to Barbara Roberts, but the fact is that other candidate in there swiped the votes that would have had Dave Frohmeyer as our governor. Norma ran a great campaign, and she just happened to get, you know, lose the race. And so that didn't have anything to do with conservative liberals. Matter of fact, Norma would be certainly considered maybe on the liberal side of moderate, not liberal, but on that side of moderate. But yes, you're right. As a matter of fact, I would say to you that we should have done better than Sizemore. But you know, people have to make their own decisions about running for office. There's several that I think would have made good candidates. Thought about it. I'm not going to tell you who it was, and they just backed off. Incidentally, I want to tell you this. I had decided on my media availability that, and Denny Miles was a good advisor in this. He said there's three answers you can give the media when they ask a question. One is I know and I can tell you. One is I don't know, but I'll find out. And the other is I know, but I'm not going to tell you. It's this last one that drives you nuts. But and it was so much fun because they'd keep asking the question from different angles. And I said, I know what you guys are doing. I already told you I'm not going to tell you. The classic on that kind of a thing is that I remember I said, now we're ready for no matter what the Bhagwan does. Well, what is that? Well, I'm not going to tell you. Because obviously if I told him, the Bhagwan would know. And I don't, that's the kind of I know, but I'm not going to tell you. Which direction? There we go.
Governor Morgan Holm with OPB. While you were governor, you oversaw one of the biggest changes in the state tax system prior to Measure 5 in 1990, and that was the repeal of the unitary tax. For the sake of a little history, I wonder if you could just explain what the unitary tax was and why you were so interested in having it repealed, first of all.
It's interesting that I was on a tax committee the entire time as a legislator, House and Senate. And we had a multi-state tax commission. And I didn't fully understand what that was all about, but what that was really all about was protecting the unitary tax. And the states like Oregon that had an income tax, and we wanted to protect the fact that we could do the unitary tax. We didn't want the federal government interfering with it. Actually, the unitary tax is not a tax at all. It's a system of taxation. And the system is that you take the entire balance sheet of a company, international or multinational, and then you say, and this part's ours. In order to do that, you have to look at their books. And the foreign countries are reluctant, businesses are reluctant to have us look at their books. Japan, and I would add, although less so, I mean in terms of media attention, England. England was just very upset with this whole thing. Now I'm governor, and incidentally, I always supported a multi-state tax commission. I was a supporter of that. And finally, I came to realize that it was an impediment in terms of economic development, and economic development was very important to me because, well, in 82, again, when I was running for re-election, we were 12.6% unemployment in Oregon. And so we need to diversify our economy. And the unitary system was an impediment. So I went to work, and I knew enough about it. I remember the whole thing. Talking to my Department of Revenue, and I'd say, look, this is what we want to do. Well, you can't do it that way. Yes, we can. No, you can't, Governor. Go back and work it out because we can do it that way, and it turns out that's the way we did it. So it worked out well. I would say to you that, again, historically, Morita of Sony was sort of a leader through Keidanren, which is the big business group in Japan. And his assistant was Chris Wada, who was a delightful gentleman. His office was in New York, but he was in Oregon. And he said to me, "Now, Governor, what do you want me to do?" I said, "Stay away. I'll take care of it." And we did. And then I knew that Keidanren was going to, through Sony, or Morita, was going to write a report on various states. I knew that. And I wanted to make sure that they got the information that we repealed the unitary system of taxation before the report was written. So we called right away to Japan. He was on the golf course. We got him off the golf course and told him. I'm telling you more that you want to know. But anyway, it's kind of nice historical stuff that never reached the light of day.
Well, and I ask that with a little bit of a reason, because it's, you have a lot of background in the state's taxation system, and since 1990 there have been some other big shifts, and I'm just curious about your opinion in light of your experience with that, particularly the one where we've seen a lot of the income tax burden shift from businesses to individuals. Do you think that's the way the state's tax system should be headed, or are there some adjustments, you think, that need to be made to kind of share that burden a little better than it has been under the current system?
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as a fair tax, mine or anybody else's. That just doesn't exist. When you talk about tax reform, you're just shifting it around. Who's going to pay it? Now, having said all of that, there are ways to distribute it a little bit better. The first thing is that ballot measure 5, the discussion never took place, that historically local government relied on the property tax and state government relied on the income tax, and neither one of us invaded our selected taxation. Ballot Measure 5 shifted that hugely, moving it all over, a large part over to income tax. In other words, we're going to lower property tax, and now state, you make up the difference that the government, local government just lost. That discussion on local control never was argued at no point in time. So now, all of a sudden, now there's a heavy weight on income tax. And that's okay as long as the economy was good. And incidentally, we did diversify the economy, and our economy has been good. And so that turned out to be okay. But still, there's a huge imbalance. I will go back to 1985. There was a bill that I supported for the first time at a sales tax. Up to that point, never supported a sales tax. And it was a well-balanced plan. It lowered income taxes. It was a sales tax in there. Put the sales tax in the Constitution. It capped the growth of property taxes. That's the quick of what it was. It was a well-balanced program. If such a tax plan came up today, it would be very good for Oregon. I don't think a sales tax, however, will ever pass. So I think we're just going to have to muddle through what we've got.
One last follow-up question on
this
thread. Do you think it's even possible, given the momentum of the tax system, to have a conversation in the state about a major change in tax policy, or is incremental change really what we're left with?
So far, no. I talked to, Governor Roberts, and I said to Barbara, people don't think there's a problem out there. You know, they were trying to find a solution to ballot 5 at that point in time. And I said, Oregonians don't think there's a problem. You have to tell them there's a problem and get them to understand there is one and that they agree to it before they're going to vote for anything. And even today, they don't think there's a problem. So as long as they don't think there's a problem out there, there's no hope for any change in taxation.
Governor Peter Wong from The Statesman again. I'd like to ask you further about international trade. I think now you're widely credited as the governor who gave a great start, but at the time, I remember there were criticisms of your foreign trips. One of the former columnists of this paper even called you Trader Vic. How do you deal with that? How did you see international trade? I know it was during the recession, but how did you see that it had potential to boost Oregon's economy?
I really am glad you asked the question. I mean, because I've thought a lot about it. I worked very hard. You're right about this facetious Trader Vic thing. Well, I don't know if they were facetious at the time. But anyway, you're right about that. And I watched us go forward. I watched us grow. I watched high tech come. I watched international trade. I watched tourism come full-blown. Forestry, wood products come balanced. I saw us with international, really international air with Delta. And then all of a sudden I see it's going backwards. And it's very distressing to me to see that it's happening that way. And I would tell you that I've said, because again, let's go back to the fact I was a retailer at one time, and I know very well that we dealt with the carpet companies that called on us. And we didn't deal with companies that didn't call on us. And so as this is where the Trader Vic came in, I made repeated visits to Japan and Korea and Taiwan and to some degree Hong Kong, because these were countries that we did business with. And you call on your customers and, of course, try to get some more. I didn't see that happening. For a while, it was very important for governors to make the trips. Where I was criticized for going, it got to a point where you were criticized for not going. And I thought, well, that's good. But that kind of passed. And we didn't call on our customers. And yes, I know there's a recession in Korea and Japan. Taiwan continues to do well. But you just have to go and make it important. And the Japan office has been threatened time and again. We've had changes in directors. You know, there's just not that much careful attention. And so it was almost like, we've got them. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Let's go worry about something else. And didn't realize the business side of nurturing your customers.
Governor Attia, one of the hallmarks of your administration was weekly press availabilities, media availabilities, which is something that has not happened since. And in today's climate, Governor Kitzhaber has infrequent media availabilities where he takes extensive questioning. Why did you do that? And why do you think that practice is no longer continued?
I suppose there'd be a large philosophical answer to you that I think the media is an important element in our society, and that it's important to kind of shed a little daylight to the public on what's going on in their government. And there was an element of that. Strange as it may seem, the other element was that I really enjoyed it. It was a highlight in my week. I look forward to it. And incidentally, I do want to make the distinction, because it took a while for the media to understand. Media availability was different than press conference. Press conference means I've got something I want to say. Media availability says, what do you want to talk about? And I will say this, that it did happen time and again, that, and I would enjoy that, I would say something deliberately that would beg for a follow-up, and there wouldn't be a follow-up. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But no, I'm serious about it. I enjoyed it. I have in my office, you know, as you get as a governor, all kinds of things, plaques and things of that kind. And this calligraphy thanking me from the media, from the Capitol Press Corps, for my availability, that's right my desk, and it's right there, right in the middle. I'm proud of that, because I don't know if any politicians have ever been thanked by the media for being available. So there was some philosophy to it and a great deal of personal pleasure out of it. I really look forward to it. I would tell you one other thing. You didn't ask this question, but we had, I call it a special session, because the legislature didn't do anything about property tax relief. And so I told them, if you didn't do it, I'm going to call you back. I called them back. Ed Failey was part of that. And I'd have these meetings in my conference room trying to hammer out, you know, what would be an acceptable program. And I'd go at it for some time, and I'd come out, and I, the conference room was there. I'd come into the reception office, and the media's all there. What happened? I said, I don't have anything to tell you. Nothing happened. And we had another meeting, and the same thing. Nothing happened. They were all there. And third time. And then finally, I've had a meeting about the fourth time, and I said to Ed Fady particularly, look, I'm sick and tired of this. I'm not going to go through this anymore. I'm going to just go out and tell the media what I think ought to happen, whether you agree to it or not. I'm going to go out and tell them. So I go out, and there's not a soul out there. And I got a hold of Denny, and I said, Denny, now I've got something to say. Oh, and it was also interesting because the next sequence comes from him, because there was a big hearing on some controversial bill in the Senate, and the media was all down there. So he went around whispering to the media, and they were packing up and coming up. And the senators watching what was going on. They were losing their audience. And they finally adjourned the committee because there was no media there to listen to what they had to say. But anyway, I enjoyed that.
Governor Attia, Richard Aguirre again with the Statesman Journal. What is your position on term limits, and how do you think that's changed governance in Oregon?
Someone came to me before the last election, and they wanted to have my support for a ballot measure that would extend the years that legislators could serve. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to repair something that I dislike. If you come to me with a measure that's going to repeal term limits, I'm there. Term limits really just out the door went institutional memory. It was incredible what the people of Oregon and the legislature lost. And as I said earlier, that what's going to really happen is the bureaucracy is going to run government because they're the only ones that have any experience. Well, the rest come and go. And this is a people, you know, people are elected to make these decisions. We didn't elect the bureaucrats to make the decisions. So if somebody comes to me and says, we want to repeal it, I'm there right now. And I think we make good arguments for doing it. They think they're going to improve the equality. They're all the bad reasons. You can't improve the quality. People come and go. They'll do some nutty things because they can't stay there very long. It's just a bad deal all the way around for Oregon.
Governor Attia, Colin Fogarty with OPB Radio. I want to ask you about your predecessor, Governor Tom McCall, and his effect on Oregon politics in the last 20 years. Governor Kitzhaber, of course, has received the same criticism that previous governors have seen, which is, you know, it's kind of an understated, well, you're just not Tom McCall. How important is, first of all, the legend of Tom McCall? I mean, having known him, I wonder about seeing, you know, hearing about him as a legend compared to the actual person that you knew. And also, did Tom McCall sort of spoil the governorship for every governor after, in a sense, because it's impossible to live up to his charisma?
Well, Tom McCall, I said many times, while he was alive, in his presence and not in his presence, will go down in history as one of the great governors in Oregon. That, however, was not because of ideas that he conceived. Most of the things that he gets credit for, he didn't conceive at all. It's, of course, well known the bottle bill was not his. As a matter of fact, he opposed it first time around. But Tom had the unique ability to, once he grabbed a hold of something, he really ran with it, and he became the front runner of it and became identified with it, and it became successful in great controversy. I was there. The bottle bill was very controversial. Land use planning, very controversial. Not just controversial, very controversial. But he was there and pushing forward, and so that was the genius of Tom McCall. His ability to say things in a very marvelous way. I told Ron Schmidt one time, why don't you make a deal with the governor? I said, why don't you write his speeches? Let him write it. You write his ad libs, because it's the ad libs that really got all the attention. So Tom was good. Did he spoil it? Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. They said, you know, that started out with about, well, that isn't the way Tom McCall would do it with me. Hey, I said, I'm not Tom McCall. I'm Vicatia. I've got my thing. I'm going to do my thing. As a matter of fact, because I was there, I think the state survived the recession really quite well. Because I was there, the economy of the state was diversified. Now, I said publicly and privately that where we had Oregon done an excellent job on natural resources, and we had land use planning, bottle bill, cleaning up the rivers and the environment and all the rest, I'm going to devote myself to the human resource. And that, of course, included jobs for Oregonians, among other things. Now, that's not as exciting to you, meaning media, as bottle bill or clean up the Willamette or whatever. I understand that. But Tom was a leader in that. I introduced him one time in his presence, and I said one of the things I admired was his tenacity. He'd hang on. He'd hang on whether he was right or wrong. But that was the great element of Tom, his ability to articulate things so well and just to grab hold of something and run with it. I never felt I was in the shadow. I wasn't trying to be a Tom McCall because I'm not one. I'm Vicatia, and that's who I'm going to be.
You've been listening to a Newsmaker interview with former Oregon Governor Vicatia. He spoke with reporters and staff from OPB Radio and the Salem Statesman Journal Tuesday, March 20th in the offices of the Statesman Journal. This program is a production of OPB Radio.